invite you to turn to Luke chapter 1, as I will be reading the first four verses. In my two most recent morning sermons there in July, I gave you the beginnings of my reasons for why I thought the Christian faith trumps the atheistic faiths and the pantheistic faiths. I say the beginnings because so much more can be said and should be said. Now, this morning, I'd like to say more about my confidence in Christian theism as opposed to Jewish and Muslim theism. And honestly, the short and simple answer to why I am a Christian and not a Jew nor a Muslim is I trust the Gospels. We have great reasons to trust the Gospels, and I want to share a few of mine with you this morning. But let me say this. Before I read our text, this is my approach, and I suspect it's your approach, too, whether you've thought about it or not, in reading any account of history. First, I acknowledge that most everything I believe about history, I believe because someone I trust told me or wrote it down. Secondly, I think we all begin by giving the author the benefit of the doubt. That is, I adopt the attitude that they are innocent until proven guilty. I believe what they are telling me until there is too much internal inconsistency, until I encounter too much self-contradiction. If the Gospels were to say that Jesus rose from the dead on Sunday morning in one place, and then, no, he actually rose from the dead on Wednesday night in another, of course that compromises our confidence in it. Or if the eyewitnesses were to say something that contradicted well-substantiated external phenomenon like, there was no such person as Pontius Pilate, while we have evidence that cannot be refuted that he did. I have little choice. You have little choice but to doubt them. And then thirdly, I give most credence to first-hand eyewitness reportage. Were they there? Did they see it? Did they hear it? Did they experience it? And after first-hand eyewitness testimony, I choose to believe those reporters who, while they may not have been there themselves, they interview and investigate as many first-hand eyewitnesses as they can. And I believe that's what we have before us in these first four verses of Luke's chapter 1. Would you follow along as I read? Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. Would you pray with me, please? Our Father, I pray by your Spirit that for the believers gathered here this morning, you would give us more confidence that our faith is well placed. It's reasonable. For those that might be here and are seeking, I pray that you'd give them reason to believe. And Lord, if we have some that are more doubtful, skeptics of all this, I pray that you'd give them reason to doubt their skepticism. And I ask that you would do it as gently as possible or as firmly as necessary. But Father, I pray that you would make each and every one of us in here want truth more than comfort, more than pleasure, more than riches, more than popularity. I pray this in Christ's name. Amen. I choose to believe Luke and the other evangelists, Matthew, Mark, and John, until I can no longer. I choose to take them at their word until I am forced not to. Luke said he looked into this history, quote, having followed all things closely for some time past. He gave it careful investigation. He thought about reporting his information in a way that made sense to his readership by, quote, writing an orderly account, also in verse 3. He told us he interviewed firsthand eyewitnesses in verse 2. He himself was not there, except for some of the events he speaks of in the book of Acts, the sequel to Luke. But he does the next best thing for us. He seeks out and finds and interviews those who were there. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as I said, referred to them before as the evangelists, provide us with the most comprehensive biographical information we have on the historical character of Jesus of Nazareth. The following three reasons strengthen their credibility in my eyes. Three this morning and two this evening. And they are these. Their constant appeal to actual historic persons, places, and events. Number two, their divergent accounts of the same event. And number three, their inclusion of counterproductive material. All of that strengthens their credibility in my eyes. So let's begin with the first. Their continual appeal to actual historical persons, places, and events. I'm going to read four verses from the next chapter in Luke. Luke chapter 2. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration, when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to be registered, each to his own town. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem. Notice how Luke locates this event, the birth of Christ, in geographical space and historical time. This is so far from once upon a time in a land far, far away. These are reported to us as actual events. There really was a registration. Not the second one, but the first one is when the birth of Christ occurs. There really was a birth of a baby. And these are actual places. Syria, Galilee, Judea, Nazareth, and Bethlehem. And Caesar Augustus and Quirinius and Joseph are all actual people. By locating the birth of Christ in geographical space and historic time, Luke is inviting further inquiry. As if to say, if you find what I'm saying hard to believe, I understand, if you do, but check it out for yourself. See if this squares with what we know. Got nothing to hide. When the Gospels were written, a number of first-hand eyewitnesses were still living. And from time to time, some of their names are appealed to in the Gospels. Take, for example, what we find in Mark chapter 15, verse 21. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. Names of the people whom Jesus interacted with or healed are not always mentioned, not by name. And so we get a little description from time to time like, a rich young ruler, or a woman who had a discharge for X number of years, or a blind man, or a leper. But when we are given names, that was the evangelist's way of saying, if you don't believe me, if you want this to be verified, go ask Alexander. Go ask Rufus. If their father carried the Lord's cross, they're still with us. Go ask Bartimaeus. Go ask Simon the leper, who lives in Bethany. Bethany's a small enough village. Just ask for Simon, who once was a leper. You're sure to find him. I say, by locating the birth, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth in geographical space and historical time, the gospel writers invite further inquiry. And that way they lead with their chin, as if to say, where am I wrong? What didn't I get right? Correct me if you find a mistake. This is objectively verifiable. And all of that gives credence to their words. C.S. Lewis was a world-class literary critic. And he said, I have been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, and myths all my life. I know what they're like. I know none of them are like this gospel. There are only two possible views of the Gospels. Either this is historical reportage, or else some unknown ancient writer without known predecessors or successors suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic, realistic narrative. He's saying ancient fiction was nothing like modern fiction. And we need to keep in mind that for a good bit of the time that C.S. Lewis was reading and specializing in poems and romances and vision literature, legends and myths, he was an atheist for much of that time. He had his motivations and reasons for not wanting the Gospels to be actual historical reportage that could be relied upon and found trustworthy. To accept them as such would mean a huge paradigm shift in his thinking and in his behaving. But his commitment to follow the evidence where it led him to believe the Gospels were historical reportage. That's the first thing that makes them more credible in my view. The second is their divergent accounts of the same event strongly suggests their lack of collusion. These were eyewitnesses willing to stand on their own two feet. There are only two miracles common to all four Gospels: the feeding of the 5,000 and the resurrection. If we were to set the four accounts of the feeding of the 5,000 next to each other, we would find just what we might expect. Four accounts that differ in detail. Some provide more and some less, but all agreeing in the main. I like to, as an illustration, as I begin my course on the Gospels, choose four students to work independently from each other and write a paragraph about how I had begun the first 10 minutes of class. I collect them and I read them to the class, and they're just what you would expect. They vary in detail, but they are the same on a whole. Very realistic, first-hand eyewitness testimony. If they had written down everything word for word the same, all four individuals, then you and I would likely conclude there was collusion going on. They got together and they wanted to make sure they got their story straight. Strikingly, there seems to be little worry on the part of the evangelists about how they might appear if they report the same event differently from one another. I find that amazing. I find it compelling. Not just in small things, like John will say, there was lots of green grass where we fed the 5,000, whereas the others leave that detail out. But big things. In fact, the most consequential thing, the resurrection. Details surrounding the resurrection. This is big. This is huge. Paul would say that if this didn't happen, we're the biggest fools on the globe. You would think the evangelists would want to circle the wagon and make sure they're telling the story of the resurrection the same. Consider this. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And the earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened. And many bodies of the saints were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those with him keeping watch over Jesus saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, "Truly, this was the Son of God." An earthquake around the resurrection, the crucifixion and the resurrection. You think that's memorable. I think it's memorable. I think it's newsworthy. It should have shown up in all four. But it only shows up in Matthew. I find that very interesting. Each evangelist was not afraid to stand alone on what they saw, heard, or remembered concerning the most important historical event of all time. That builds my confidence in each one of them. How many angels did Mary Magdalene see when she went to the grave on Easter Sunday morning? Matthew mentions one. John mentions two. Uh-oh. If John's gospel was written later, and it is widely accepted that it was written later, it's extremely probable John was familiar with Matthew's account of the resurrection. And you would think John would feel incredible pressure to agree with Matthew concerning the number of angels present on that Sunday morning. Yet he still mentions two, knowing Matthew had only mentioned one. Won't this compromise the veracity of their narrative? If there ever was a time for collusion and getting their story straight, the resurrection is that time. Let's not open ourselves up for textual criticism unnecessarily. But John sticks with what he saw, what he remembered at the peril of weakening their collective testimony in the eyes of some. Why? Why do that? Perhaps he's giving his readership the benefit of the doubt. Perhaps he thinks his readers are more intelligent and they won't jump to the conclusion that the mention of one angel by Matthew and two by him, John, must absolutely be a contradiction. he's okay with it looking like an apparent contradiction, while in fact it is not a real one. A real contradiction would be if Matthew said there was only one, or John would have said, no, there were actually two, not one. To mention only one when there are two present is not a contradiction. We have other examples of that in the Gospels as well. Take the demon-possessed man who was filled with the legion of evil spirits. Jesus sends the demons into the swine who proceed to run off the cliff. Matthew tells us there were two such demon-possessed men that Jesus healed on that very occasion, while Mark and Luke only mention one. Matthew tells us Jesus healed another blind man at the same time that he healed Bartimaeus there in Jericho, while Mark and Luke only mention Bartimaeus. It's not a contradiction to mention only one, even if two are present. Oftentimes, only the more prominent of the two are mentioned in such instances, perhaps because one is the primary spokesman. Consider how much self-control each evangelist had to write down either what they saw, heard, remembered, or what they thought was the most important, what would serve their own unique purpose in reporting the best, instead of caving into collusion. This, too, strengthens their testimony in my eyes and makes it so much more real, authentic. And then the third this morning, two more tonight, just plugging in to come back tonight. The third this morning is their inclusion of counterproductive material. And honestly, I had never thought about this until about 5 or 6 years ago when I read through Tim Keller's book, The Reason for God. I found that line of reasoning in his book. Why include information about Jesus and the apostles upon whom the church would be built? Why include information about them that makes them look bad or doesn't seem to promote the cause, the mission? I mean, after all, if Christianity is a mere human invention, and these human inventors are trying to pass it off as the way and the truth and the life, wouldn't they have deleted those teachings and sayings and actions that make their leader and themselves look bad or weak? I invite you, the next time that you find yourself reading in the gospel, prayer, something like this: Lord, show me. Is there any counterproductive material here in front of me? I think you'll find lots. I only have time for a few examples. I'll mention a few more tonight. Got ahead of myself here. If I were one of these final editors, a human inventor of this new religion, trying to get the biggest sales out of these new gospels we're going to send out there in order to gain greater traction, I would not include the Lord's coming down from the Mount of Transfiguration, met by a man who is quite distressed and pleads for the healing of his demon-possessed son with the words that you and I first read in the Gospels. We are expecting to read something like this: Jesus looked upon that man with pity and said, "Bring him to me." But instead, what we find are these words: "To this man, O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me." the leader of this new religion, the leader that they want us to worship as God, sounds incredibly impatient here to me. He seems to offend unnecessarily. And though he will heal the boy, he seems to do it begrudgingly. If I were one of those final editors, I would strike all of that and just leave the last line that said, "Bring him here to me." Why all of this counterproductive? Why run the risk? That's not flattering on the one we're supposed to follow as Lord and God. Tim Keller points out that the Lord's Prayer in Gethsemane, "Take this cup from me," three times, could be viewed upon from some on the outside who are not Christians, but looking at Christianity askance, might say, look it, their leader is losing his resolve to finish the course. He's looking for a way out. Or, my God, why have you forsaken me there on the cross? That too, from outsiders who don't want to believe, seems like a weakness on his part. Why did the evangelist permit material that risked not reflecting well on the one who is at the center and core of this faith? Let's move on to the apostles. And let's forget about their pettiness and cowardice. Let's just move right to their unbelief. And remember, this after witnessing more miracles than John can count. We're in the upper room on Easter Sunday evening. 10 of the apostles are gathered, and Jesus appears in his resurrected bodily form. They're all there except for Thomas. They all can't believe their eyes. Overwhelmed with both fear, we're not used to seeing things like this, and joy. It's really true. It's really true. And yet that fear and that joy, clearly an altered mood and state on their faces, cannot convince one of their own? Thomas? This does not bode well. If these guys are supposed to change the world with their testimony, they can't persuade one of their own? That's not very hopeful. Notice how Matthew ends his gospel in chapter 28. It's not the very end, but it's in near the very end. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they, again, these same apostles that have already seen Jesus at least twice in the upper room, except for Thomas, and more likely they had seen Jesus do other miracles too in the 40-day period that he was still with them before he ascended. These people, when they saw Jesus there on the mountain, were told in verse 17 of Matthew 28, these 11 disciples worshipped him, but some doubted. What? These 11 guys saw him at least twice in the upper room, probably other places too, teaching him, them, what to expect, preparing them for the mission. They're still doubting. Why include this unless it actually happened and they're just being honest? With every read through the Gospels, my confidence grows in their testimony because of their continual appeal to actual historical persons, places, and events, and their divergent accounts of the same event, and their inclusion of counterproductive material. But I want to close with this thought. If the Gospels were man-made fabrication, the writers didn't do a very good job of concluding this book, did they? I can write a better ending. You can write a better ending. And that doesn't take a lot of imagination on our part. If I want to make this story read better and gain more traction, I don't have Jesus only walk into the upper room unannounced. I have him walk into the Sanhedrin with Caiaphas. I don't have him appear to Mary Magdalene first, whose testimony cannot be counted in court in that culture because she's a woman. I have him appear to Pontius Pilate and Pilate's wife, who is having these dreams about having her husband not having anything to do with this Jesus person. What an ending. How much more convincing and persuasive. It seems to me that either the evangelists missed a golden opportunity, or they told us the truth, and nothing but the truth. Amen.